you want, to Asa Zenkai. Beautiful environment, vine and branches, accompanied by the birds. So today I'd like to talk about what in Zen we call don't know mind. And I'd like to start with a few lines from a poem by Yeats. It's called The Second Coming. Turning and turning in the widening Gaia, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And so I can really relate to those lines. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And something we've seen in the last few years, partly caused by the pandemic and then amplified by social media and YouTube algorithms, is that real intensifying of sometimes quite extreme opinions. And of course, people have always had, there's always been people with extreme opinions. But I think, yeah, what's been happening is that it seems so much easier to get down to those rabbit holes, and for people that we all know, we probably all know people who've sort of ended up there and suddenly have quite extreme views, and you think, where did that come from? And in a time of anxiety, sometimes people feel very drawn to people who can provide certainty, you know, so a lot of these online personalities and influencers have a lot of certainty, and, you know, you just do this and you just do that. Often there's something they can buy as well that will help. Whereas for scientists, especially something new like a new pandemic, there's a lot of uncertainty, and, you know, I think to the best of our knowledge, and then that knowledge changes and more data comes in and research has to be done, and so it's a very sort of different narrative. So it's not easy to sit in that space of uncertainty, anxiety. And the other things that's been happening is things like the Me Too movement, but also really recognizing in Australia our Aboriginal history, and, you know, things like massacre maps, stolen generations. We have in Victoria the Yurok Commission looking into stolen generations. And so there's a lot going on where we are constantly being asked to look at our unconscious bias and re-examine our assumptions. We also have a lot of royal commissions, and really they're actually all quite shocking. So we've had into institutional abuse, aged care, mental health services, at the moment disability. And yeah, it's really that sense of, you know, what's happening with our institutions and these organizations that are meant to be taking care of people, and then all of these things are happening. I sort of had a very, when I was young, I had quite a stark example of, you know, how I saw the world and then how suddenly that changed quite naturally. So I grew up in Munich, and I was a Catholic altar girl. And I was one of the first. So there was, you know, for a long time, there was only altar boys, and then we sort of changed the policy, and then altar girls were allowed to be part. And so I was one of the first. And I enjoyed that. And the priest was very supportive, so that was a very positive experience. And then a few years later, in my early teenage years, I was preparing for confirmation with a different priest, and he didn't allow altar girls. And I sort of just asked him about, you know, why there were only altar boys. And he said, well, the altar boys is often, you know, how we get the priests. And of course, women can't be priests, and therefore we don't have altar girls. And I went, oh yeah, okay, fair enough. You know, I just totally accepted that because I'd never met a female priest. And now, of course, we have a lot of female ministers, you know, not in Catholic Church yet, but certainly Anglican, Uniting, other denominations. And now I certainly wouldn't be going, oh yeah, you know. but it's really, when you grow up, you just have these sort of blinkers on, and we don't even realize half the time that we've got them until things change. I've also been working in the last 10 years in Aboriginal health, and last 4 years in particularly in reconciliation. So working for a health organisation, which is part of Department of Health, and looking at our Reconciliation Action Plan. And that is actually a whole lot of having to bring a don't know mind to that space if you're not if you don't have Aboriginal heritage. And it's quite interesting because for some people that comes quite naturally, so they kind of know that they have to question their assumptions and they're really engaged. And then for others in the organization, and I think that happens in any organization, they kind of know they have to be seen, you know, they definitely have to talk the talk, tick the box, but there's a real reluctance to really go very far with that sense of actually questioning sort of the assumptions of mainstream health. And so in that space, we have something called Close the Gap, which you may have heard of. And that's actually bipartisan government policy, which has been around for more than 10 years. And it's around closing the gap in things like life expectancy between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians, and also school, justice, things like that. So there's a whole lot of targets, early childhood education, things like that. And a whole lot of targets, and then each year the Close the Gap report is presented to Parliament, and like I said, it has had bipartisan support, and this has been going on for more than 10 years now, and a lot of money and resources, you know, pulled into trying to close this gap, and it hasn't worked. So a couple of the indicators have slightly improved, like early childhood education. But most of them are either stable or have actually deteriorated in that time. And so there's an awareness that for mainstream health and government organisations that we don't actually know what to do here, you know. There's a real sense of whatever we're doing, it's not working, so we have to try something new. And in the sense of having to, look at our unconscious bias, sometimes, you know, it's called decolonization of our mindset, and do things differently, but what does it actually mean? With the Reconciliation Action Plan, there's sort of three main domains. So one of them is about respect, and that's all about learning about Aboriginal culture and the history and of what happened. So learning about some of the protocols, about what is a welcome to country, what is an acknowledgement, learning about the impacts of colonization, learning about cultural protocols and things like that. And sort of really that sense of having to learn and being very open-minded again, not knowing, you know, what the answers are. And then the second one is about relationship, and that's about engagement. And organizations are really being asked to engage meaningfully with the Aboriginal community. And again, that can be, you know, often quite tokenistic. So there's things like, you know, we have to do community consultation. So I've seen that many times. A service will come in, everyone sits around, gives the feedback, they tick the box, disappear back to the office, and the community never hears from them again, let alone any sort of, you know, follow-up about, yeah, we've heard what you've said and this is what the outcome is. And, the engagement and takes a lot of long-term, you know, commitment really to meaningfully engage in that space. And the Koori Mail had a sort of, one of the communities sort of in the Koori Mail described the services coming in like a flock of cockatoos. And so they come in, they screech a lot, make a lot of noise, shit all over you, and then take off again. And that's sort of how it often feels to community. And as some of you know, it was actually Penny who recently passed away, who sort of was my introduction into working in Aboriginal health. And she found out that I taught Tai Chi, and she said, would you like to maybe do some Tai Chi with the Elders Pair group? And I said, I'd love to do that. That would be wonderful. So she organized it for that to happen. And then I got a bit nervous, and I thought, I'll just, you know, have you got any advice for me before I go in? And then she said, so the first thing you need to do is you need to sit down and have a cup of tea and talk about yourself. And so usually that's the last thing, you know, usually I'm going to a workshop, run a workshop somewhere with a group, an organization, and pretty much the last thing I would do is sit down, have a cup of tea, and start talking about myself. But of course, it was really good advice because it was really about the relationship and the elders having a sense of who are you. And then once they have a sense of who are you, then it's what can you offer. But that's kind of how it works. It's not what do you do. Like often in our professional lives, it's very much what do you do. Who are you kind of takes a second step. But for the engagement, it's really, yeah, who are you? And then that genuine connection. So you share a bit about yourself. And then it's also important what you do is, you know, that obviously matters as well. But the first part is that genuine, who you actually are. And in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne where I work, there's a lot of stolen generations, so a lot of people living with the impact of that. So it's, you know, sometimes people think remote communities, 300 kilometers from the doctor or something, and, you know, things like that, so the challenges are there. Whereas in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, you know, there's doctors all around and allied health and what are the barriers, but there's actually also really real barriers as well. And part of that is that impact of stolen generations and just a deep mistrust of mainstream institutions, understandably. So part of that work for me is that constant looking at my assumptions and being able to question them and supporting my colleagues also in doing that. And another one that really stood out for me is was a talk, I think it was the NAM Oration, Melbourne Uni, by Professor Michael Sean Fletcher, who's at the Melbourne Uni Indigenous Knowledge Institute. And he was actually talking about that concept of wilderness. So, you know, I'm a greenie, I love bushwalking, camping, being out, no people around, isn't this lovely? And, you know, wilderness society, so I've always really related to this idea of wilderness. But he actually pointed out that before colonization, there was no such thing as wilderness at all, because all the land was managed by people. And that was a sort of quite a big shock to me. And I realized that actually that idea of wilderness is almost the same as terra nullius, like that empty land, you know, so things like that. So yeah, it's that real sense of just constantly having to question your assumptions. And I guess the main thing I've learned in more than 10 years of doing this work is that everything's very complicated. So as soon as you think, oh yeah, I've got a little bit of a handle on this, something else comes along and go, oh, actually no, that's not really what's happening. And so one of the, in terms of, you know, our mental health and well-being, one of the most common things that people suffer from is anxiety and depression. And so anxiety disorders are very common and really impact on people's lives often. And of course, since we've had COVID and all these bushfires and now inflation and war in Ukraine, these are also increasing. And so one of the things that we can really, the gift of something like a Zen practice is developing that ability to sit with anxiety without immediately becoming reactive or avoiding. So in Four Noble Truths in Buddhism, we have greed, you know, so with this dukkha or suffering or unsatisfactory nature of existence, and then these are caused by greed, hatred, and ignorance. Or sometimes we can also refer to them as grasping, aversion, and Jeff Dawson sometimes calls it apathy or ignorance. And I think we can all really relate to that sense of noticing our grasping mind, whether it's grasping after experiences or after sensory things or after objects or things like that. And we also, when we do Zazen regularly, we're quite aware of our aversion. So, you know, I don't want to go here, I don't want to sit with this. And so when we do Zazen, we sort of notice the grasping, the aversion. But I think the ignorance part or the apathy part is a little bit harder maybe sometimes to sort of notice and really work with. And that sense of you're not really having the answers, but knowing that we don't really have the answers. I think that's one way of sort of thinking about the ignorance part. And so when we sit, we learn over time not to do the grasping, at least not while we're on the cushion, and become more aware of it, not to do the aversion as much, you know, sort of be more open to things. And then also to understand a little bit about how our thinking is often very self-centered and very much caught in a certain way, you know, that the knowing mind, that we think we know it, and then becoming more aware that actually there's things that we don't know. And I'm sure you've all had experiences of doing Zazenko or session where you sort of sat with a feeling of anxiety or something, and then it might have got worse and worse, and then just being able to sit with it and how strengthening that is. So in psychology, that's called affect tolerance, so the ability to sit with unpleasant feeling states without reacting or avoiding them. And I remember my first 5-day retreat, which was actually in the Tibetan tradition out in the Healesville, and it was sort of day 2 or 3, and it was very hot afternoon. The afternoon's always hot anyway. And there was, next door was this trail bike going up and down, up and down, and up and down. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm getting a bit irritated, and it's going up and down. So I'm getting a bit annoyed, and I'm sitting there, and then I'm getting angry. And then I'm full of rage. And then I'm sitting there. So it's just, yeah, it was such a good example of, you know, how things, when we don't actually escape from it, we go through these emotions, and then we're just sitting. Just sitting, yeah. So I think sometimes when we are really in that don't know mind, I think that can sometimes feel almost a bit helpless, like we are a young child and we don't have the answers, we don't have the solutions. And we hear more and more about climate anxiety, and especially for young people, having that real sense of, you know, deep anxiety around climate. And I think it's probably not just young people, I think at a certain level we all have that sense. And again, it's one of those things, a bit like Aboriginal health, where, you know, there's things being done, there's things happening, but is it enough? Is it actually changing? Is it actually getting worse? And to sort of really sit with all that and just to know, actually, I don't have a lot of the answers. I mean, I'm certainly going to try and do certain things. So, you know, that sense of respect, so I'm going to learn what's required, for instance, about, you know, what I might be able to do. That relationship of engagement with the natural world and with the feelings around the environment. So there's things we can do, but ultimately there are no easy solutions, and so how do we sit with that? In terms of ignorance, I guess one of the things, ways we can work with that is that real sense of curiosity, developing a sense of curiosity, and just asking some of the questions. So when we meet someone, we can sort of prejudge them quite quickly, and then we start talking to them, and then suddenly we learn all these different aspects of them. And I found that a lot working in community health on hospital settings, and you meet people and, you know, you sort of prejudge them a certain way. But especially in situations where there's a lot of suffering, they might start sharing things with you, and you really start to get to know them, and you just ask a few more questions, and there's this enormous sense of, wow, I had no idea this was happening for that person, and the depth of their experience. And so, yeah, in terms of the don't know mind, that can be really helpful for us, for ourselves, so we don't really know fully what's happening for ourselves in our engagement with others, and also engagement with life generally. Having that sense of curiosity and openness to experience, and as much as possible being aware of when we start to prejudge ourselves and our own experience or the experience of others.